Perek Sheni, Pirkei Avos, Mishnah Ches. Af huwa Golgothus achas safa al pnei hamoyim. These are statements that Hillel said. One time, he was by a river and he sees a skull floating in the water. Amar lo, and he says to it, al da atifs atifuch, v'saf metafayach yutufun. Because you killed someone, you ended up being killed like this. And those who did this to you will have it happen to them as well. And Rabbi Yon explains, essentially, that everyone is wrong. This one leads to the other, leads to the other. And it's the concept of Megalgalin Choyva Ayde Chayiv, that bad things are brought about through bad people. And ultimately, we have an expression that we say what goes around comes around. And that's basically the message here. That there's a mida keneged mida, that people who perpetrate bad things will have bad things happen to them as well. Hu haya omer mishneh tes, he would also say, marbe basar, marbe rima. One who is too fleshy, one who is too heavy. So when he's buried, there'll be more decay going on with his body. Marbe nechosim, marbe da'aga. One who has an increase in property and material wealth will have plenty of worries. Marbe avodim, marbe gezel. Person who has many servants will have a lot of stealing going on. Marbe shfachos, marbe zima. And if he has a lot of maidservants, there'll be a lot of immoral behavior. Marbe noshim, marbe kshofim. And if he has many wives, they will be inclined to do magic. Marbe teira, marbe chai. One who increases in his Torah will increase in life. Marbe chachma, marbe yeshiva. One who increases in wisdom will increase in his yeshiva of sitting and pondering. Marbe etza, marbe tevuna. One who gives counsel will have understanding. Marbe tzedakah, marbe shalom. One who gives charity will bring peace. Kana shem tov, kana la'atzmo. If you acquire a good name, that's something you have. Kana lo devei Torah, kana l'chayim abo. And if you acquire Torah, you have olam haba. It's a lot of things. And Rabbi Yoin explains, marbe basar, a person thinks that if a man thinks that if he will enjoy from this world, it'll add life, he'll naturally be better off if he eats more. And the Mishnah is saying it's not going to help. The day will come when he will pass from this world, and whatever physical entities that he increased will wither and decay. Marbe nechasim, a person has more property, so he'll think that maybe I could have enough put away, I can live my life out, tranquil, pleasant. And that's not true. It's marbe da'aga. He'll have worries. He'll have worries about what will happen to my wealth. Will it last? Will it get lost? And Rabbeinu Yonah says, if you doubt, ask them. Ask the Ashirim, and they'll tell you that they do worry. Marbe avodim, marbe shvachos, and marbe noshim. He says it's as if he did it. The way Rabbeinu Yonah understands the Mishnah, when it's marbe avodim, so it's marbe gezel, marbe shvachos, marbe zim, marbe noshim, marbe shvachim, he kind of blames the person who is being marbe. It's your fault. You're being marbe avodim, so it's your fault that they're going to steal. You're marbe shvach, it's your fault when they do znus. If you're marbe noshim, it's your fault that they will engage in kishuf. Why are they engaging in kishuf? Because each one wants to cast a spell to make sure the husband likes her more than the other wives. So whatever it is, he is creating a situation where this is going to happen, so he's accountable. And the flip side of it is the marbe Torah, marbe chayim. You want chiyus? Don't think you'll get chiyus through the food you eat, through the things you purchase and acquire. That's not chiyus. Chiyus comes from Torah. And a person wants shalom, shalom comes from tzedakah. It's maybe counterintuitive, but this is what Hillel is disclosing, the secret of serenity, the secret of the good life, if you will. It's a world that's revolving around Torah and mitzvahs, and the Rabbeinu Yonah actually explains it's corresponding to the first part of the Mishnah. When he said Marba Torah, Marba Chayim, it's against Marba Basar, Marba Rima. Because you think Marba Basar is what gives you Chayim. And he's telling you it's not true. It's Marba Torah, it's Marba Chayim. And you think Marba Nechasim is going to give you Chiyas as well. And it's not true. It's Marba Daiga. Torah, if your Torah is what you Daiga, if you're concerned about Torah, if you're worried about Torah, that's fine. That's not going to hurt you. And that's going to be good for you. And he goes on to say how daiga, the true daiga, when people have nechasim and they're worried, it's bad for the heart, it's not good for you. But for someone who is concerned with Torah, it adds life and it's beneficial. So all the first half of the Mishnah is describing the things that people imagine will be good for them. You know, today, all over the news, person can spend $2 and buy a ticket for a lottery and maybe win over $500 million, $500 million. And what are you going to do with it? And they're interviewing people and talking to them, how would you spend it? And they talk to financial people and how would you invest it? They don't that often tell you the odds of winning are 1 in 170 million. Very long odds. But that doesn't stop people from dreaming. If you're creative mind, you could dream without buying the ticket. But any event. So what do people think? They're going to buy things. They're going to eat things. They're going to increase things. And you'll have all your butlers and your maids and your servants and your houses and your cars. And you think that is going to give me a sense of relaxation, a sense of balance, a sense of calm. And it's not true. There have actually been studies. People have done studies of what happens to these people who win these multi-million dollar lotteries. What happens in 10 years later? Someone studied 10 years after. Many of them are broke, a lot of them are depressed. They can't handle it, and they don't enjoy life. It didn't give them everything they dreamed of, because their dreams are misplaced. And what Hillel is telling you is, you want Chaim, and you want serenity, and you want shalom, and you want peace. This is how you do it. You focus on Torah, on tzedakah, on mitzvahs, and that's what you spend your time with. And if that's what you spend your time with, you'll have chiyus, you'll have shalom, you'll have menucha, you won't have the daigas, and you won't have the rima, and you won't have all the things that the Mishnah begins with. So, in the big picture, we always talk about it's like priorities, what's important and what's not important. In this Mishnah, he's putting it in the context of, it's not a question of important, not important. This is good life and not such good life. This is to determine peace, chiyus, tranquility, shalom, what is the key? And the description is, termis is now maybe, if you wanted to secularize it a little bit, you'll say it's leading a meaningful life, which makes sense. In other words, it's not about me, and it's not about what I can enjoy or take from this world. It's living on a higher level, which is definitely true. How does a person achieve that? How does a person do that? And that's with Torah and mitzvahs. That's how we accomplish that. And ultimately, the last two parts of the Mishnah, Kana Shem Tov, Kana La'atzmo. There's nothing you can acquire that can't get lost except for a good name. So you can have all kinds of things and you live in a community like Seagate and it's gone. One storm and all the things you have are disappear. But a Shem Tov doesn't disappear. Kana Shem Tov, Kana La'atzmo. That is something that will always stay with you. And Kana Divei Torah is right the next level. That's Kana Chaya Omaba. If a person wants to prepare for the next world, so the key is Torah. And we've said in the past, Mitzvahs as well, or supporting Torah, connecting to Torah, different ways of wording that. Now, Hillel, maybe he was the wrong person to teach us this lesson. He is stating it as a fact, and it is such. Hillel, we know from the Gemara, was exceedingly poor. Hillel was the one about whom the Gemara says that after 120 years, when we go to Shemayim, Hillel is Mechayev the Anim. Hillel is the one who is going to make it difficult for a poor person to argue his case that I couldn't learn and I couldn't do as many mitzvahs as I would have liked to because I didn't have the money. If I had more money, I really would have learned more and I would have done more, but I didn't have the money. And they're going to say to him, "Were you as poor as Hillel?" And it describes how Hillel had nothing. He would go chop some trees and he would sell the wood, and half the money he earned would support his family and half he would pay the Beis Medrash. And he was sitting and learned. He had nothing. And that's the story, that one time he didn't sell the wood, that he had no money, but he didn't want to miss out, so he went up to the roof and it snowed on top of him and they thought a skylight was dark because Hillel was up there. Hillel didn't have money. Later on, the Rambam says that the Mefarshim say the Kalim of the Rambam say that Hillel later on became a yeshiva. When he became a yeshiva, he stopped chopping wood for a living and he was supported. But during his earlier years, he didn't have money. He was as poor as they come. And the Gemara says, you weren't poorer than Hillel. And Hillel still made a point of learning a lot of Torah. So you can't say, well, I was too poor to learn Torah. You weren't more poor than Hillel was, and he still learned Torah. So from Hillel's perspective, money is not an ideal. And that's not chiyus, and that's not shem tov, and that's not olam haba, and that's not shalom. But him, it was Torah, it's mitzvahs, and so on. So maybe it would have been a better raya if Rabbi Elazar ben Chasam said it, who the Gemara says was so wealthy that he's mechayev the ashirim. Because people will say, I was too wealthy, I was too busy monitoring my property and assets, and I had no time to learn. Had I had a little less money, then I would have had more time to learn. So they say, well, were you as rich as Rabbi Elazar ben Chasam? It describes in the Gemara how amazingly wealthy he was, and he would just like ignore all that and go to Beis Medrash to learn Torah. So no matter which end of the spectrum you're on, you're not going to have an excuse to say, I had no time to learn, I was too busy either earning because I was too poor or managing because I was too rich. So Rabbi Elazar ben Chasam would say, take it from me. Marba Basar, Marba Rima, Marba Nechosa, Marba Daika, Marba Avoda, Marba Gezel. The key is Marba Torah, Marba Chai, that's it. So maybe it would be more embracing of the concept. But the emes is emes regardless, whether it's Rabbi Elazar ben Chasam who says it or Hillel who said it. The emes is there, and I think anyone will tell you that Mar ben Chasam, Mar ben Daiga, we all know that Mishnah, it's on our lips. People who live simply have less concerns. You buy a car, your first car, you have to worry about the car and maintenance and take care of it, and then you get a house one day, and the house needs maintenance, and the house needs being taken care of, and whatever it is, whatever you're going to increase in your fortune, so to speak, needs oversight and upkeep, and it's a daiga. It is absolutely a fact. Ask anyone, like Abenian says, ask anyone who has, and they'll tell you, it's marva daiga. There's no question about it. That doesn't mean that we're going back to horse and buggy. Horse and buggy also have daigas. I mean, whatever it is going to be daigas. So the trick is not to be marba. You have nechasim that you have to have. What you have to have, but not to be marba. As he doesn't say not to eat. Marba basa marba rima. So what does that mean? I shouldn't eat anything because if I eat whatever I am, I'm going to decay into earth after 120 years? No, it doesn't say that. Just don't be marba. Don't go overboard. Don't do an excess. And it's not even saying not to have avodim. You need avodim. In those days, today we also have avodim. The avodim are my dishwasher and my washing machine and my dryer. These are avodim. The mechanical avodim. In those days, they didn't have these things. So they had people doing it for them. So people had to have. They had to have one, two, three, whatever it was. We didn't have to have a lot. The more you have that you don't need, The excess is the problem. But basically, Hillel is saying stay away from the excesses. Like, marber noshim, marber kshafim. Does that mean you shouldn't get married? Of course not. It just means don't be marber noshim. Marber noshim, you're asking for trouble. So it's a question of not going over the boundary of what is considered necessary and what a person needs to make do. And if you want to go overboard, then you go overboard with Torah, with Chachma, with Eitza, with Tzedakah. These are things that the excess will not be harmful to you. These are things that you can do more than minimally required and will have no detrimental effects afterwards. In the Mishnah Zion, two Mishnahs back, Hillel said, Lo kol ha-marbe b'schor machkim. Not everyone who is busy with schayva will be wise. And the way Rabbi Yonah puts it, he says, if a person is busy with his business all day long and he has a little time to learn, he'll never be a chacham. Lo yischakim le'olam. And the way he describes it is, his schayva is the ikur and his Torah is aroy, or the schayva is keva and Torah is aroy, he'll never be a chacham. Hill is basically telling us these concepts between these two Mishnayos, that if you want to succeed in Torah, if you want to accomplish in Torah, you're going to have to minimize your engagement in Schayra, in Parnasa. And if you want to achieve and accomplish, then you're going to have to put in serious time to your Torah study. And we've mentioned in the past, this is why many Gedolei Yisrael feel that Bachrim should, in their early young years, before they're married, focus on their Torah study and not so much on Parnasa, which eventually they will have to support a family. But in the time that they have, that they can focus on Torah, they should be marbe as much as possible. Because later on, it'll be very difficult. Even if a person... the highlight of his day is the time he spends learning. When he's working, it's going to be a fraction of the time that he has, because most of his time will be at work. So if lo kol ha-marbe b'schor machkim, you have to make sure he's a chacham before he's marbe b'schor. You have to make sure that he's first achieves a certain level of chachma, and then when he's busy with schor, when he's busy with work or business or whatever he's doing to support his family, he'll have time every day to learn, which probably will be end up... For some people it's learning new, for many others it's review. I'm sure in the ideal world it's going to be review of what he's learned before to keep fresh that which he already spent hours and years on earlier, you know, full-time study, and then later on he won't have that kind of time, but he'll be able to review the material in a more brief, quick fashion and retain what he had learned. But ultimately, in the scheme of things, he's not mentioning here in this Mishnah test about Schayra. He did that before. Before he said that lo kol ha-marbe machkim. It also implies there could be exceptions. But as a standard, lo kol ha-marbe is going to machkim.
So if somebody learns a lot until they get married and have a family, and then that's good, 25, they learned a lot, and then they go to work. So then the rest of their life, they're repeating the level they're when they're 25, and then they never go past that?
Well, when you're reviewing, you're constantly going over things you have learned, assuming it's a sizable amount, you will continue to grow. When you learn something a second time, it's not the same as the first time you learned it, even though you're reviewing it. So when you review it many, many times, it's always something different, something, a deeper understanding, something unique about it. So it's not a question of remaining stagnant, so to speak. It's. I think review is underrated. Many hold the review is the ikkar learning. Not people think learning something new is the main thing. It's not really true. It's really being able to go back to what you've learned with new knowledge, perhaps, and then look at it again. Look at it a second time. Look at it a third time. Look at it a fourth time. It's very rare that someone who's reviewing gets nothing new out of it the last time. If he's not getting anything new, he's probably not reviewing it right. A true chazara is going to understand it deeper and better than the previous time. That's, I think, pretty standard. And that's why we're always encouraged to review, because it's not so glamorous, and it's really where all the profit is, so to speak, when you now really get it, that you didn't get it as well before, and now you understand it even better. So it's very important. Today, there are all kinds of programs where people learn and take tests. So that's good, because when you take tests, you're kind of forced into reviewing. It creates a requirement to chazak, to review. And it's like a built-in external motivation. But all the great gedolim that we know of, always hundreds of times. You know, how many times they've gone through Shas and Shulchan Aruch and things? In the hundreds. So it's really the ikkar of learning. You know, there's only a certain amount that's finite between Shas, Bali, Shulchan, whatever. I mean, in Chaim Kanievsky, he's reviewing every year. Right? This is the ikkar of the learning. Eventually, it's going to be the chazar. So it's not in any way a concept of, well, then you're not going to grow. That's how you grow. You grow through the chazar. Hillel made another point back in Mishnah Zayin that we didn't discuss when he was explaining this idea of lo kol amar b'schar machkim. He added one more thing. In a place where there are no men, you should strive to be a man. And the Rebbe Yonah puts it as, if there's no one out there who's going to inspire you and motivate you, then you have to do it to yourself. You have to be self-inspiring and self-motivating. But we know the way we use the term, or some people just say, where there are no men, you should strive to be a man. Sometimes you have to take responsibility to do something that you'd rather not do, but there's no one else doing it. So someone has to take care of it. Someone has got to pick up the slack. Someone's got to fill that hole, so to speak. And to a great extent, this kind of explains again the phenomena of why we encourage young men so much to spend their time learning, even if we know down the road they're not going to pursue a livelihood in Klei Kodesh perhaps, or it's not like they're doing it for Parnosa. There aren't that many people out there learning. Now you may think, all the people you know, or there's a lot of Jews in the world. Only a small fraction are religious Jews. And of the religious Jews, only a fraction of them are spending a lot of serious time learning. So it's clearly a b'makom she'ein ish, or b'makom she'ein anashim, hishtad lios ish, that we have to strive. There's a marshal that the Chafetz Chaim gave, and it was used by others after him, that in time of peace, an army will be arranged in groups of officers and lower level soldiers, and there'll be rigorous training till you get promoted from one level to the next. And they're going to make sure that whoever occupies a specific position is totally qualified for that position, because they have the leisure of rigorous training and education to accomplish that. But in times of war, when the officers are getting killed in battle and you're bringing in new recruits and you don't have enough trained officers to fill the positions that need to be filled, you're going to start filling positions with people who are not adequately prepared and trained, because you have no choice. Under the circumstances, we need to promote people who maybe would have been a three-year program. They took 1.5 years. Okay, you've graduated. We're not going to put them through the last 1.5 years, because they still know more than the people who are just coming in, being drafted into service. So when things are desperate, you have to change the way you run your army. So Chafetz Chaim said, the same thing is true when it comes to Torah. And I know Rav Moshe applied it to Smicha. There used to be a time that perhaps they'd require rigorous training to be a mechanech, to be a malamed, to be a Rosh Hashiva, to be a Rav. And that would be fine if everything was peaceful and serene and there was no hurry and no desperation, no mochama, so to speak. But given the state of affairs, things have deteriorated to the point that we are required to fill the ranks with people who are as trained as we can get them in a short period of time. And therefore, the requirements were reduced. And they used to say, I don't think it was a joke, that Rav Moshe would give smicha and on the back of the paper was his phone number. And he would say, when you're in a rav in a city and they have a shal, you can't just call me. Because he knew we don't have the luxury of training them until they're capable of answering all the questions that I come to them. They need Rabbanim to go out, and that's what they did. Now, I think by now, today, that has changed to a certain extent, that there are people who have the time to pursue their studies and training to the point that they become much more prepared for the roles that they pursue later on. But overall, in Klai Yisrael, there's a lot of b'makom she'ein anashim hishtadlios ish. There's a lot of room for people who have to assume responsibilities they may have otherwise not chosen to assume, but simply because there's no one else who's going to do it, and it's got to be done. And this includes people who go on shlichus all over the world. This includes people who go join kollelim all over the place. People who end up teaching, who maybe never imagined they would be a teacher, but they're in a community with a day school who doesn't have a teacher, and as a Beis Yaakov graduate or seminary graduate, you'll end up knowing more than most people there, so you become the mechaneches and the teacher. You're put into these positions where maybe this is not what I planned on doing, but given the circumstance, I'm the best person for the job, so a person has to do that. And that's the concept of Makom She'ein Anashim Hishtadlios Ish. Person has to realize that sometimes, even though this is not what I intended, this is not maybe what I imagined, but I should be open-minded. I might be the best person for the job, and if that's the case, I should do it. Again, in the more densely populated areas, maybe there's less of an issue. But once you get beyond the more dense from communities, there are a lot of places where they need teachers. They need teachers in Denver and St. Louis and Phoenix. And you know, once you get off the beaten track a little bit, these are from communities. They have children who want to learn, and they need teachers. They need people. And people have to, some, you know, maybe this is not what I intended. For someone who does intend, perhaps it's a good opportunity to get experience to go out these places. But ultimately, if you find yourself in a place where people aren't doing the kind of things that or there's no one capable of doing it, then that's where you should hishtadlios ish. You should realize that this is maybe something that I should be doing and take responsibility for, since no one else here is, as maybe I'm not perfectly trained either, but I'm more trained than the others who are doing it. So that still presents itself in this day and age, and the person has to realize that this is the responsibility they have.
Then are they held responsible the same way if they don't do as well as?
No, they're not. Person won't be held responsible if he is doing his best. You do the best you can, even though it's not what someone else who would be more trained would have done, but that's fine.
Well, maybe you should prepare better then.
You always got to do your best. But had you had a few more years training, perhaps you'd be even better. But you can't. Now, again, this is probably something that Hillel experienced himself, because the Gemara says that when Hillel came to Eretz Yisrael, the Bnei Beseira were in charge. They were the Hashivas, they were the Bnei Nesiim, and there came a Shiloh one year with Korban Pesach, and they didn't know what to do. They had the position by Yichus, basically, it was in the family, and they didn't know what the halacha was, and Hillel knew. And when Hillel was able to answer their questions, the Bnei Beseira, to their credit, stepped down. And they said, we're giving up our post, and we're giving it to Hillel, because he knows more than we do, and he should have the position. It's tremendous humility on their part, the Bnei Beseira, that they did that. And the Gemara records it for all time, posterity. That's how Hillel got this position. It wasn't like he came vying for a position. Remember, he was this poor person who had nothing to his name, and he sat and learned. And when he came to Eretz Yisrael, he finds himself in a position where he knows more than everyone else. So they promoted him, like basically as soon as they discovered who he was and what he knew, and he took the job. And almost like there's no choice. It's Makom She'enish, so he's got to take the job. If you would have asked him, is he the one for the job? Baruch said no. And we know this is true many times. You find it by Shaul HaMelech, he didn't want to be Shaul King. We find the Gemara says others who were Rosh Hashiva that they did not want to be appointed in that position or that position of authority. But sometimes there is no choice. You have to do it. And that's what the Chafetz Chaim was saying about the Rebbeim and the Rabbanim of his time, and certainly later on after World War II, when there was such a shortage, then it was necessary to fill the gaps. And even people who would not have felt that this was for them took that responsibility because there was no one else to do it. The next Mishnah Yud brings from Hillel's Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai kibel mehil v'shamai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai learned both by Hillel and Shammai. And hu ya omer, he would say, im lamadat the Torah harbe al taksa Torah la'atzmecha. If you learned a lot of Torah, don't feel good about yourself, kil kach matzarata, because really that's why you were created. This is why you were put into this world. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Gemara says, was from the smallest of Hillel's Talmidim. Hill had many Talmidim. The greatest was Rabbi Yonasan ben Uzziel. And the smallest of his Talmidim in stature was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And the Gemara goes on to say that the smallest of his Talmidim, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, knew everything. He knew Gemara, Mishnah, Tanakh, and Mishnah, and Gemara, and Medrash, and Agarata. And he knew what the birds were saying when they were chirping. He knew what the trees were saying when they were moving in the wind. He knew everything. That was the smallest of Hillel's Talmidim. So the Gemara says, so if that's the description of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, how do you describe Rabbi Yonasan ben Uzziel, who is the greatest of the Talmidim? The Gemara says, well, when Rabbi Yonasan ben Uzziel would learn Torah and a bird would fly overhead, the bird would be incinerated. Like the fire on Har Sinai that burned on the top of the mountain, when Rabbi Yonasan ben Uzziel learned Torah, there was a fire. Maybe you couldn't see it. If a bird flew over his head when he was learning, the bird was instantly cooked. That was the bigger Talmidim of Hillel. That didn't happen by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So he's on the lower level, a smaller Talmidim. But the wealth of knowledge that his Talmidim had was beyond what we could ever fathom. There's a story about this bird that flew by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. There was a fellow who was a very intelligent man, and he had a position of rabbanus in the United States, and he gave certification to a certain kashrus organization that none of us eat from, and he started writing books on Zohar and Kabbalah and publishing it. And the Panovich Rav, this goes back many years, Panovich Rav was visiting the United States. And he was in the city of this rabbi, and they were honoring the rabbi, and they asked Panovich Rav to speak. And Panovich Rav was not happy with this particular rabbi, and they asked him to speak, so he speaks at the dinner. And he says the story of Yonasan ben Uzziel and the bird who flew overhead, and the bird got burnt up. And he said, there's a moral to the story. I mean, he said it in Yiddish, I'm not sure exactly the words he used, but he said, the lesson of the story is that when you fly where you're not supposed to fly, you're going to get burnt up. That was the Panovich Rav's message. So, on the one hand, we learn the godless of Yonasan ben Uzziel. We also have to learn there's some things called the no-fly zone, where you have to know the limits of where you're supposed to go and where you're not supposed to go. In any event, that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He's from the smallest of Hillel's Talmidim, and he mastered more of Torah than we could ever fathom. And he would say, so you learned a lot of Torah. You know all this Torah. You can't think you're anything great because of it. This is what you're here for. This is why you're here. And this goes back to the Pasuk, Adam la'amal yulad, and the Gemara says, man is born to toil. What kind of toil? Any odea, I don't know. Is it la'amal peh? What kind of amal is it? So the Gemara says, is it Torah? Is it field? What kind of amal? And the Gemara concludes, it's for amelus and Torah. A person was created to toil in Torah. That's the conclusion of the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So that's what Yochum is saying. You know, it's not, you don't pat yourself on the back when you do what you're supposed to do. This is what you're supposed to be doing. And don't think you're great because you're doing what you're supposed to do. That's what's expected of the person. Yeah. Fires over them? Well, we know we're nowhere near the Rishonim, and the Rishonim are nowhere near the Tanaim and Amorayim, so like, we know that. The smallest of the Amorayim were Mechayim Mason. We can't do that. We know that there's an Eskatnu Hadairis, so...
Is it not capable? Are they, is it out of reach?
I suspect it's out of reach. The greatest of the great don't come to these people. You know, as anyone who thinks they do doesn't realize how great they were. That's the bottom line. And it's just the further you go from Sinai, that's we're always getting smaller and smaller in our abilities and our stature. And anyone who thinks otherwise has no grasp of how enormous those people were. I think there was a Lashon, I forgot where I saw it. If a Rishon Meitan or Mar would come in the room, we'd be blinded. And we couldn't be able to look at it. Forget about having a conversation. So we have no hasaga, we have no grasp of these people, what they're like. Santa Gemara says in Rishonim kemalachim ana kabrei adam, and if the Rishonim are bnei adam, we're like chamorim, not even like the chamor pinchas ben yar. You know, if they were people, they were animals. We have no grasp of how great these people were. I remember seeing this recently about this idea of if we'd be in a room with one of them, we would be incapacitated. Yes.
I read recently that the concept of unus solaris is only by men. That by women, what's the difference of the role of a woman nowadays? And by sarimin, okay, it's a little bit different, but you're running the house and the mitzvahs are the same. It's like it's basically the same role, as opposed to the level of terror that a man can reach is not the same now as it was obviously by Sinai and as you get further and further away.
There's no Yeridus Adaris by women, only by men.
I learned that also. No, I think I learned
the problem with that is, how is a woman who's on Sari Mainu's level going to manage the husband who's on today's level? You know what I'm saying?
I don't think it's even like that. The role, the level of role. Meaning, like, well, a man's Torah can only reach a certain point nowadays, but technically, a woman's role is limitless.
So every woman today can achieve the Madrega of a Sari Mainu Rachel, mm-hmm. because it's all the same responsibilities.
Obviously,
that's what you're saying.
You say according to now, but you're saying if it's not according to any time, then
well, men have the same responsibilities,
right?
But the mice, they can't reach it. They can't know the amount of Torah as Moshe Rabbeinu.
Why
they can't
we reach it, but not them?
It wasn't talking about that. It's not the actual role of a woman. It's not.
And
but if the role is to learn Torah and to do mitzvahs, that role hasn't changed.
The limit of the role, meaning like the highest that a man can go now, is here, where, you know, by the time Moshe Rabbeinu, whatever, could have been whatever, and it's not the same.
Maybe it's the amount they can keep.
I don't know if it means anything. So I'm trying to think, what does it mean?
Well, ladies could just go for themselves. Just because we're yours to theirs doesn't mean that we could dress less than you, so we could be less careful about. I'm saying men can't.
But maybe that's the yours to theirs.
The what?
Dress and clothes and all that stuff.
But the responsibility is the same.
In other words,
not expected to know the amount of
let's like give it a simple example. Do you think that the girls in the time of the Nevi'im or Tanoim, Amoroim even, were going with their hair uncovered? Single girls. No. They only had their hair covered. You know, there are a lot of things we do different than they used to do. I don't know. I mean, I kind of hear the idea they're trying to say that if a woman's role is not dependent on Maimon Har Sinai, so then getting distance from Har Sinai won't change anything. So I kind of hear that. But, what?
Why wouldn't our role be dependent on Har
Sinai? I'm saying, if Har Sinai is your connection to Torah, so you're connected to Torah the same, whether we're now or then. Because you don't have a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. They may have a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So their understanding of Torah will not be the same as the understanding of Torah 200 years ago, and 400 years ago, and 600 years ago, and you know, if you go increments of hundreds, 200 years. So their grasp of Torah will be limited. And that's true. You know, it was said by the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir in New York, of Shmuel Brudny, Zichron Vacha, that he knows that Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Vacha, was not the Bekiva Eger. He doesn't know why he isn't. Which means to say, as a fact, it's impossible that anyone who lived in our times could be Rabbi Akiva Eiger. But when you learn the Svarim, like, you can't see the difference, which is a tremendous praise of Rav Moshe. He could not. And as he was saying, when I learn his Svarim, I don't know the difference. I could be reading Rabbi Akiva Eiger. In other words, it was a praise of Rav Moshe, that from our appreciation, we can't discern what's the difference. But I know they're different. They have to be different. And ultimately, we don't grasp how great those who preceded us were. I think it's beyond our ability to grasp it. So we say stories and we learn the Torah, but we don't really appreciate. So it's just a matter of, you know, Rekiva Eger ends with a question and you come up with an answer, the rest of your week will have to be, why is your answer wrong? Because it's impossible that you have an answer to the question if you were left with a question. And that's many shiurim in yeshiva is that. He asks a question, he leaves it with a question, does not have an answer, but have a good answer. And you make a whole structure to answer the question. Then you're going to have to make another 3 days to break apart why your answer is wrong. Because it's not possible that he had the question without an answer and you come up with an answer. This is a style of learning, which is very common. You can't answer Jager's kasha. Who do you think you are? It's impossible. So, some things he answered himself, but there are other things he left. He left many things just sort of.
Maybe he left them empty unintentionally.
That we should work on it.
We can look for the answers.
Right. It's unlikely. But it definitely has created a lot of Torah study. And ultimately, if you can't undo your answer, you left the Tzarechi, and I don't know why my answer's wrong. So, you left with, like, I don't know why my answer's wrong. You know, need someone who's greater to show you the
four
knowledge.
There's an answer to everything.
There's an answer. I think Tasus has questions and doesn't answer. I mean, we have the Gemara's question doesn't answer. It's a teiku. Wait for Mashiach to come. There are questions we don't know the answers to, and we're not going to get the answers to. So that's when we learn Torah, we accept that. It's an acceptance. We go on, even though you have questions that are unanswered. So it's a good question. We'll write it down. The Gemara does it. The Rishonim do it. Dachronim do it. We have questions. There are questions we'll have, and we're not going to have answers. We'll wait for the answers. So, yes, there's an answer to everything, but doesn't mean we're going to get it. Doesn't mean we grasp it. In any event, there's a lot to be studied. So, okay, I'll take the Mishnah for Yechuzaka and say it the way you're saying it. He says, if you learned a lot of Torah, don't consider yourself great, because that's what you're created for. So you could say for women, even if there's no Neskat and Hadaris, but that's what you're created for, to do your job. So you can't, the Kachmo Tzarta. It's nothing to be extra proud about. But, okay. So whether or not, you know, the Niskan Hadaris is there, it's still ultimately you put in the world to do your job. And that's it. That's what we're here for.
Is this also maybe helping? Are they saying this to prevent jealousy? Like,
I always understood it to prevent arrogance. That's how I always understood it. Don't get arrogant. Don't get haughty. Just because you learn a lot of Torah. That's what you're here for. This is not al toxic to the asmacha. It's the yisoy, this idea of not being machzik to yourself. Don't think that you deserve anything special, extra. This is what you're here for. This is what the Ibrahim put us here for. This is our purpose. This is our raison d'etre. This is why we're here. So good, do it. And again, it goes back to Adam Amal Yulot.
But that doesn't necessarily keep the whiteness, because it's like, okay, I'm doing it, but if no one else is, then I'm still better than everybody else.
No, not better than them.
But that's
you're doing what you're supposed to do, that's all.
Okay, but if someone doing what they're supposed to do, and people do
and someone who's
not,
not
doing what they're supposed to do,
they should do what they're supposed to do.
Then
no.
Someone doing what they're
I don't think so.
Just supposed to do, and someone doing even better.
I don't think you look at it that way. He says a mitzvahs too. You do a lot of mitzvahs. Don't think you're great. That's what you're here for. You're here to do mitzvahs. I think it's an attitude in general. It's not comparing yourself to anyone else. It's comparing yourself to yourself. This is what I'm here for. I'm here to do mitzvahs. I'm here to learn Torah. So that's good. That's what I'm supposed to do. You can feel good about yourself, but it shouldn't be a source of I deserve something special because of it. I should not feel entitled because of it. And if you feel entitled, you'll be disappointed. So that's part of it. Don't feel entitled. Don't feel special. Because you did it's good. You should feel happy that you're doing what you're supposed to do. It's different. You're allowed to be happy and not be entitled or arrogant. It's not a contradiction. Okay.